Dear Flock, my name's Eva Heifer-Giraud, and I'm going to read an extract from my recent book, Veganism, Politics, Practice and Theory, which came out last year. So the book was really designed to offer a bit of an overview and mapping of some quite heated debates that have surrounded veganism in recent years. But it was also designed to sort of speak to a very particular moment in veganism's history, where certainly in contexts such as the UK, it's seen an absolutely unprecedented rise in popularity. And one of the things the book was really grappling with are some of the kind of ethical, political, social and cultural changes that are happening with that popularisation. And some of the kind of potentials, but also some of the pitfalls that it was that veganism's popularisation has been creating. The two portions of the book that I'm going to read extracts from, I hope, speak to some of those broad themes. I'm going to begin by just reading a short extract from the introduction, and then I'm going to move to the penultimate chapter, which I think really gets to the heart of debates about popularisation and what that might mean moving forward. As I said, I'll start with chapter one. What if plants feel pain too? What about mice killed in harvesting? Do you refuse to use a computer or drive a car due to the animal products involved? What about all the human suffering? If a neighbourhood cat died of natural causes, would it be vegan to wear it as a hat? Depending on context, these questions might stem from genuine curiosity, from a desire to puncture perceived moralism, or simply be a joke. Something all of these queries have in common, however, is that anyone who's been vegan for any length of time will have been asked at least one of them. Well, maybe not the last question, although it certainly sticks in my mind, even though it happened in 2003. What also sticks in my mind is that at the time, as a new vegan, I found these discussions engaging or sometimes even amusing and was happy to talk through various ethical debates. In contrast, a friend found everything much less funny due to feeling worn down by years of bad faith gotcha moments, which were posed as questions but really designed to highlight perceived hypocrisies. As described in recent texts about vegan practice, these experiences were not unique, and gotcha provocations are commonplace in everyday discussions about veganism. And this is a point that's also been made, as I note in the book, in recent books by Carrie Hamilton and AFCO as well. The opening range of questions I used to start the book, the varied motivations behind them, different possible responses they can elicit, and frequency with which such debates occur, evoke something significant about veganism itself. Everyone has some sort of relationship with non-human animals, be it related to consumption, recreation, or everyday interactions with environments. The centrality of animals to society means that the questions posed by veganism, with its call to rethink and contest some of the most commonplace of these relationships, are not just relevant to the small, though rapidly growing, number of people who identify as vegan themselves. Instead, veganism speaks to practices, values, and relationships with animals that have integral socioeconomic or cultural roles, even as these relationships might vary between and even within particular national contexts. The vastness and complexity of the issues posed by vegan practice mean that even jokingly worded provocations can't be resolved in a straightforward way. My aim in this book, therefore, is not to offer a simplistic riposte to questions about veganism that I feel I should have addressed more thoughtfully in the past. Nor does the book launch a defence of vegan practice against imagined or anticipated criticism. Rather than providing any neat resolution, what I aim to do here is offer a sense of the theoretically, politically, and ethically complex issues that veganism poses at a complex juncture in its history. I argue throughout this book that in order to grasp veganism's distinctiveness as a form of food culture, it is paradoxically necessary to understand it as more than a diet. Not just due to veganism's concern with animal ethics beyond food, although of course that's important, but because of the broader ethical implications of its criticism of many existing human-animal relations. At the same time, in order to grasp the tensions that surround vegan practice, it needs to be situated as something that's in constant negotiation with markets, specific social formations, institutions, and particular discourses about non-human animals, which attempt to reduce veganism to just a diet. The overarching aim of the book is to offer a sense of how these struggles between more than and just are negotiated in ways that open up and sometimes shut down the more radical political and ethical potentials associated with veganism. I approach this task by turning to a range of informative contexts, including the formation of vegan identity, vegan activism and campaigning, popular commentaries that highlight affinities and tensions with other social justice movements, and the recent popularisation of plant-based food. Engaging with a range of examples from popular culture, debates within existing vegan scholarship, and original interview materials with long-term vegans themselves, the book develops a picture of veganism as something that's more multifaceted and complex than is often recognised, either in certain academic contexts or within mainstream media depictions. Together, the examples and debates that I draw upon throughout the book underline the importance of preserving the sense of veganism as something that interrogates the relationships that people have with non-human animals in a manner that goes beyond diet, as well as the wider political ramifications of this interrogation, in order to retain a sense of the more than. One of the difficulties of conceptualising veganism as more than a way of eating or fashionable diet in the present forum is that this book series is to get dedicated to contemporary food studies. Due to the book's necessary emphasis on food, therefore, there's a risk of falling back onto the sense that veganism is solely about eating. Yet what I illustrate across the book's 8 chapters is something that perhaps sounds a bit paradoxical. Even when discussing food itself, the discussion always ends up moving decisively beyond it. Chapter 3's discussion of high-profile criticisms levelled at vegan food, due to environmental and labour politics that are masked by labelling these products cruelty-free, as Breeze Harper's talked about in depth elsewhere. This type of kind of approach, for instance, is generative of wider debates about purity politics, lifestyle activism and identity. Furthering this sense of complexity, Chapter 5's initial discussion of big budget campaigns designed to promote vegan diets leads to wide-ranging discussions about animal subjectivity. Elsewhere in the book, such as Chapter 2's overview of vegan scholarship, or Chapter 4's analysis of grassroots activism, I discuss a range of academic and political initiatives that have sought to articulate connections between veganism and other social justice movements. The final chapters pick up on these discussions, drawing out the limitations of certain iterations of contemporary vegan practice in ways that speak to wider concerns about the class and racialised inequalities associated with alternative lifestyle politics and the limitations of market-based popular veganisms. Before sketching out a more in-depth overview of the book, however, it's important to set the stage for its overarching arguments by developing a clearer sense of what it means to describe veganism as more than a diet and how recent developments have begun to complicate this claim. And that's really what my focus is on the rest of the introduction. It's kind of really just mapping out some of the kind of tensions, I suppose, that set out the terrain of the book. I'm now going to just skip to the penultimate chapter, which is really a kind of culmination of many of the themes that I draw together in the book. And this is the chapter that probably also best speaks to the content of the interview with Marianne as well. Okay, Chapter 7, Post-Vegan, The Rise of Plant-Based Capitalism. This book began by suggesting that an important, burgeoning area of research about veganism relates to tensions that have emerged in the wake of its ongoing popularisation. As discussed previously, while the popularisation of veganism is seen as, by many as worthy of celebration, popularity also creates challenges. Certain developments have made it easier to maintain vegan practices, including broader cultural awareness of what veganism is, the fashionability of veganism, at least in certain contexts, and the increasing accessibility of vegan food, alongside a flourishing internet culture of vegan communities and support networks. These developments, however, have been accompanied by friction generated by the attendant commercialisation of veganism, which troubles its potential to be more than a diet. Questions are arising, for instance, about whether activist vegan ethics, which rethink human-animal relationships beyond food and seek to engage with other anti-oppression movements, are being displaced by a lifestyle veganism that, as Richard White has recently argued in an essay, quote, that is uncoupled and detached from related actions relevant to interspecies social justice. In other words, rather than offering a more fundamental rethinking of how particular humans relate to other beings, the popularisation of certain aspects of vegan practice, and not others, has brought the political emphasis back onto food. This chapter identifies some of the major tensions that have emerged in the wake of veganism's partial move to the mainstream, with a focus on messy distinctions that have begun to emerge between popular veganisms and grassroots vegan practice stemming from a more radical tradition. Or, put differently, the difference between a veganism that's concerned with interrogating human-animal relations in a range of contexts and as part of a wider analysis of enmeshed and multidimensional oppressions, terms that are used by Laura Wright and AFCO respectively. And what I refer to here as plant-based capitalism that centres around eating. The label plant-based capitalism itself is inspired by the reflections of interviewees who I've engaged with in my own wider research, exploring what long-term vegans who've participated in vegan practice for at least 10 years think and feel about its wider popularisation. A recurring theme across these interviews is criticism of the label plant-based, which people saw as a depoliticising term that referred solely to food and as such was emblematic of broader challenges surrounding veganism's popularity. Although plant-based wasn't perceived as intrinsically problematic in its own terms, interviewees were wary about the routine way this label was used instead of, and sometimes conflated with, veganism in contexts such as restaurant menus and food marketing, as well as within popular culture more broadly. In particular, people were concerned that labelling foods as plant-based marked an attempt to detach certain products from longer histories of veganism, even speculating that this was a deliberate act of distancing on the part of food manufacturers to take advantage of growing markets without engaging with the ethical connotations of veganism. Events in early 2020 helped to bring home the stakes of these developments, when a high-profile employment tribunal in the UK ruled that an employer, anti-blood sports charity the League Against Cruel Sports, had discriminated against one of its employees for being an ethical vegan by dismissing him after he raised concerns about its pension investment in companies involved with animal research. The judge deemed ethical veganism to be a protected characteristic under the 2010 Equality Act, and a move that, on one level, appeared to be an important legislative development for vegans. As Kate Stewart and Matthew Cole point out, however, the danger is that the addendum ethical reframes values that have historically been an integral component of veganism to instead being a fringe concern, relevant only to a specific type of vegan practice. Describing the explosion in plant-based foods as a new green rush for multinational food companies, they warn, quote, "This massive increase in the number and popularity of products without animal ingredients, frequently described as vegan, doesn't necessarily reflect the ethics of the movement that invented the word." So just as a reminder, that's a quote from Stewart and Cole. It's in light of such social and legislative developments that terms such as plant-based assume more profound meaning, epitomising tensions between, on the one hand, a desire for veganism to become more widespread, and, on the other, concern that the way this mainstreaming is happening is detrimentally narrowing the meaning and connotations of eliminating animal products by stripping vegan practice of its fundamental ethical significance. These arguments are rapidly evolving, and some thinkers have argued that the meaning of vegan should be stripped down to a simple definition as a dietary practice for the purpose of maximising inclusivity and clarity. There's a really helpful piece by Dirkowitz and Jonathan Dickstein about this. Yet, though such interventions are both valuable and thought-provoking, the social and cultural affordances that veganism is assuming in the present moment illustrate potential risks in detaching the ethical. This chapter unpacks some of the tensions surrounding the new green rush of plant-based capitalism, drawing on insights from my interviewees alongside a range of examples that form the backdrop of popular vegan culture, including social media, blogs, recipe books, marketing materials, agricultural reports and pro-vegan campaigns. Building on the approach taken in the previous chapter, which sought to centralise and learn from scholarship from a critical race studies perspective that interrogated the dangers of post-race alternative food landscapes, this chapter engages with complementary work that's criticised post-feminist media discourse. By reading these developments in popular veganism against this body of feminist research, I identify several emergent themes which constitute what can be thought of as a post-vegan sensibility within popular vegan culture, A sensibility which places the emphasis on individual consumer-oriented action as opposed to structural change. The developments that characterise post-veganism, however, are perhaps more ambivalent than post-feminism, which, as I outline in more depth later, is itself a highly complex cultural phenomenon. As the popularisation of veganism also carries really hopeful political potentials that complicate a straightforward reading of post-veganism as entirely apolitical. And I'm just going to jump forward a few pages, because the bit after this is literally me just unpacking key kind of theoretical terms in post-feminism, which might be less interesting. I'm just going to kind of skip to my first section where I lay out some of the key themes and components of a kind of post-vegan discourse, with a section called Just a Diet, which kind of summarises some of the key concerns from people I spoke to when I was doing this project. One of the biggest sources of ambivalence associated with contemporary veganism is the shift from it being difficult to live as a vegan to vegan food becoming readily available. Indeed, when asked about the biggest change they'd experienced over the past 3 years in relation to veganism, the majority of my interviewees responded food, or more specifically, the widespread availability of food. Interviewees often jokingly described how they were delighted at being able to take train journeys without relying on crisps or peanuts, or being able to go for a meal with friends without packing their own bottle of soy milk or vegan margarine. This line of reflection is perhaps best crystallised by Ginny, who's been vegan 14 years, who states, "It's wild in comparison to what it was a few years ago. Vegan food and the understanding of veganism within food outlets has become so well known and popular that I've almost started to become complacent, because it's like, well, why isn't there a vegan chocolate eclair for me to eat right now?" These shifts were often articulated not just in terms of food availability, but marketing. Saskia, who's been vegan for 25 years, for instance, describes how she was initially able to, quote, block out a lot of marketing as it just wasn't relevant to her, but now increasingly feels, and again this is a quote, kind of shouted at by vegan brands being promoted in the urban environment. As these reflections suggest, though product availability was often discussed in positive terms, there was also a creeping sense of ambivalence, with individuals concerned that the flip side of accessibility was a depoliticisation of what it meant to be vegan. For some interviewees, its commercialisation ran the risk of disconnecting veganism, not only from other social issues, but even from animal ethics itself. The ramifications of a narrow focus on vegan food, as opposed to veganism that's more than a way of eating, came to the fore throughout discussions. Interviewees voiced concerns that the long-standing emphasis on making vegan food more accessible, once really important for sustaining veganism, has now, paradoxically, become a barrier to realising more expansive understandings of vegan ethics. Several interviewees voiced concerns that key sites for promoting vegan politics, such as vegan fairs and festivals, have undergone a shift, arguing that were once radical spaces which drew attention to different forms of animal exploitation and supported community building, have shifted to a more individualistic emphasis on food. And this is a quote from Sol, who's been vegan for 43 years. I mean, on the one hand, it's really good to see these vegan fairs going on, and the really big ones that attract tens of thousands of people, you know, they're all right, but it's all about food. There's very little activist groups there. There's very little ethics there. It's all about me. What can I eat? And others voiced wider concerns about the limitations of going to chain restaurants with new vegan options, as opposed to, quote, the classic vegan cafe that has, you know, posters for your local environmental group or whatever, ALF stickers, cultural signifiers of something that goes further than this is about what I spend my money on. Ali, who's been vegan 12 years, echoed these concerns, again worrying that in recent years the emphasis has been placed on a liberal individualistic push to expand consumer choices rather than instigating structural change. It is now more about, and this is a quote from Ali, it is more about accessibility and fashionability of veganism, and trying to attract as many people to go vegan as possible rather than focusing on actually like setting up vegan structures. Ali argues instead that we do need to take the focus off the individual and put it on the corporations who are doing all this farming and who are the ones that, even if everyone turned vegan tomorrow, would just change their style into producing vegan food. And I think two things are especially worth dwelling on in relation to these reflections. The first is that people are actively drawing connections between the widespread availability of vegan food and depoliticisation of vegan practice, due to this process maximising individual choice within the constraints of existing systems, without asking questions about how to transform these systems. And this was a point that was reiterated by almost everyone I spoke to. The choice to eat whatever one desires was thus seen as coming at the expense of reflecting on how the systems producing particular foods were entangled with other forms of animal, let alone human oppression. The second notable point relates to the commodification of veganism. It would be easy to make the argument that the rise of plant-based capitalism is primarily due to the actions of corporations who've seen the potential of new vegan markets. Questions also need to be asked, however, about whether some of these developments have been aided and abetted by certain strands of the vegan advocacy movement itself, which is often centralised food politics. Perceptions of the inaccessibility and expense of veganism are often perceived as one of the key barriers to entry. Tensions can arise, however, if food and dietary choice in particular is centralised in awareness campaigns in ways that become entangled with corporate strategies, rather than kind of focusing on more kind of radical democratizing potentials. I'm going to stop there for the sake of time. But in the rest of the chapter, I've kind of focused on a slightly negative note. But in the rest of the chapter, in the conclusion of the book, I do try and end on a note of far more hope. Even though people did talk about the negatives and were concerned, many people also raised points about the democratising potentials that were being opened up with accessibility and how this kind of tension between food justice and accessibility on a kind of class level is a kind of constant site of struggle, and that maybe there is kind of something hopeful to learn moving forward about kind of veganism's popularisation for all of those tensions. So thank you very much for listening. It was great to have me on our hen house, and I hope you've enjoyed the reading. Mm-hmm.